take, and then writing down the probable consequences of each step, and calmly coming to a decision. If I hadn't done that, I might have floundered and hesitated and done the wrong thing on the spur of the moment. If I hadn't thought out my problem and come to a decision, I would have been frantic with worry all Sunday afternoon. I wouldn't have slept that night. I would have gone down to the office Monday morning with a harassed and worried look, and that alone might have aroused the suspicion of the Japanese admiral and spurred him to act. Experience has proved to me, time after time, the enormous value of arriving at a decision. It is the failure to arrive at a fixed purpose, the inability to stop going round and round in maddening circles, that drives men to nervous breakdowns and living hells. I find that 50% of my worries vanish once I arrive at a clear, definite decision, and another 40% usually vanish once I start to carry out that decision. So I banish about 90% of my worries by taking these four steps. 1. Writing down precisely what I am worrying about. 2. Writing down what I can do about it. 3. Deciding what to do. 4. Starting immediately to carry out that decision. Galen Litchfield became the Far Eastern Director for Star, Park, and Freeman Incorporated, representing large insurance and financial interests. This made him one of the most important American businessmen in Asia, and he confessed to me that he owed a large part of his success to this method of analyzing worry and meeting it head-on. Why is his method so superb? Because it's efficient, concrete, and goes directly to the heart of the problem. On top of all that, it is climaxed by the third and indispensable rule: do something about it. Unless we carry out our action, all our fact-finding and analysis is whistling up wind. It's a sheer waste of energy. William James said this: "When once a decision is reached, and execution is the order of the day, dismiss absolutely all responsibility and care about the outcome." In this case, William James undoubtedly used the word care as a synonym for anxiety. He meant, once you've made a careful decision based on facts, go into action. Don't stop to reconsider. Don't begin to hesitate, worry, and retrace your steps. Don't lose yourself in self-doubting, which begets other doubts. Don't keep looking back over your shoulder. I once asked Waite Phillips, one of Oklahoma's most prominent oil men, how he carried out decisions. He replied, "I find that to keep thinking about our problems beyond a certain point is bound to create confusion and worry. There comes a time when any more investigation and thinking are harmful. There comes a time when we must decide and act and never look back." Why don't you employ Galen Litchfield's technique to one of your worries right now? And write down the answers to these four questions. Here's question number 1. What am I worrying about? Question number 2. What can I do about it? Question number 3. Here's what I am going to do about it. Question number 4. When am I going to start doing it? Chapter 5. How to Eliminate 50% of Your Business Worries. If you're in business, you're probably saying to yourself right now, "The title of this chapter is ridiculous. I've been running my business for 19 years, and I certainly know the answers, if anybody does. The idea of anybody trying to tell me how I can eliminate 50% of my business worries, it's absurd." Fair enough. I would have felt exactly the same way myself a few years ago if I'd seen this title on a chapter. It promises a lot, and promises are cheap. But let's be very frank about it. Maybe I won't be able to help you eliminate 50% of your business worries. In the last analysis, no one can do that except yourself. But what I can do is show you how other people have done it, and leave the rest up to you. You may recall that earlier in this book I quoted the world-famous Dr. Alexis Carroll as saying, "Those who do not know how to fight worry die young." Since worry is that serious, wouldn't you be satisfied if I could help you eliminate even 10% of your worries? Yes? Good. Well, I'm going to show you how one business executive eliminated not 50% of his worries, but 75% of all the time he formerly spent in conferences trying to solve business problems. Furthermore, I'm not going to tell you this story about a Mr. Jones or a Mr. X or a man I knew in Ohio, vague stories that you can't check up on. It concerns a very real person. Leon Shimkin, a former partner and general manager of one of the foremost publishing houses in these United States, Simon & Schuster, Rockefeller Center, New York. Here is Leon Shimkin's experience in his own words. For 15 years, I spent almost half of every business day holding conferences, discussing problems. Should we do this or that or nothing at all? We would get tense, twist in our chairs, walk the floor, argue, and go around in circles. When night came, I would be utterly exhausted. I fully expected to go on doing this sort of thing for the rest of my life. I'd been doing it for 15 years, and it never occurred to me that there was a better way of doing it. If anyone had told me that I could eliminate 3/4 of all the time I spent in these worried conferences and 3/4 of my nervous strain, I would have thought he was a wild-eyed, slap-happy armchair optimist. Yet I devised a plan that did just that. I've been using this plan for 8 years. It has performed wonders for my efficiency, my health, and my happiness. It sounds like magic, but like all magic tricks, it's extremely simple when you see how it's done. Here's the secret. First, I immediately stopped the procedure I had been using in my conferences for 15 years, a procedure that began with my troubled associates reciting all the details of what had gone wrong and ended up by asking, "What shall we do?" Second, I made a new rule, a rule that everyone who wishes to present a problem to me must first prepare and submit a memorandum answering these 4 questions. Question 1. What is the problem? In the old days, we used to spend an hour or two in a worried conference without anyone's knowing specifically and concretely what the real problem was. We used to work ourselves into a lather discussing our troubles without ever troubling to write out specifically what our problem was. Question 2. What is the cause of the problem? As I look back over my career, I'm appalled at the wasted hours I've spent in worried conferences without ever trying to find out clearly the conditions which lay at the root of the problem. Question 3. What are all the possible solutions of the problem? In the old days, one man in the conference would suggest one solution, someone else would argue with him, tempers would flare, we would often get clear off the subject, and at the end of the conference, no one would have written down all the various things we could do to attack the problem. Question 4. What solution do you suggest? I used to go into a conference with a man who'd spent hours worrying about a situation and going around in circles without ever once thinking through all possible solutions and then writing down, "This is the solution I recommend." My associates rarely come to me now with their problems. Why? Because they've discovered that in order to answer those 4 questions, they have to get all the facts and think their problems through. And after they've done that, they find in 3/4 of the cases they don't have to consult me at all because the proper solution has popped out like a piece of bread popping out from an electric toaster. Even in those cases where consultation is necessary, the discussion takes about 1/3 of the time formerly required because it proceeds along an orderly, logical path to a reasoned conclusion. Much less time is now consumed in the house of Simon & Schuster in worrying and talking about what's wrong. A lot more action is obtained toward making those things right. My friend Frank Betker, one of the top insurance men in America, told me he not only reduced his business worries, but nearly doubled his income by a similar method. "Years ago," said Frank Betker, "when I first started to sell insurance, I was filled with a boundless enthusiasm and love for my work, and then something happened. I became so discouraged that I despised my work and thought of giving it up. I think I would have quit if I hadn't got the idea one Saturday morning of sitting down and trying to get at the root of my worries. 1. I asked myself first, just what is the problem? The problem was that I was not getting high enough returns for the staggering amount of calls I was making. I seemed to do pretty well at selling a prospect until the moment came for closing a sale, Then the customer would say, "Well, I'll think it over, Mr. Boettger. Come in and see me again." It was the time I wasted on these follow-up calls that was causing my depression. Two, I asked myself, what are the possible solutions? But to get the answer to that one, I had to study the facts. I got out my record book for the last 12 months and studied the figures. I made an astounding discovery. Right there in black and white, I discovered that 70% of my sales had been closed on the very first interview. 23% of my sales had been closed on the second interview, and only 7% of my sales had been closed on those third, fourth, fifth, etc. interviews, which were running me ragged and taking up time. In other words, I was wasting fully one half of my working day on a part of my business which was responsible for only 7% of my sales. 3. What is the answer? The answer was obvious. I immediately cut out all the visits beyond the second interview and spent the extra time building up new prospects. The results were unbelievable. In a very short time, I had doubled the cash value of every visit I made. As I said, Frank Boettger became one of the best-known life insurance salesmen in the country. But he was on the point of giving up. He was on the point of admitting failure until analyzing the problem gave him a boost on the road to success. Can you apply these questions to your business problems? To repeat my challenge, they can reduce your worries by 50%. Here they are again. 1. What is the problem? 2. What is the cause of the problem? 3. What are all possible solutions to the problem? 4. What solution do you suggest? Part 2 in a nutshell. Basic techniques in analyzing worry. Rule 1. Get the facts. Remember that Dean Hawkes of Columbia University said that half the worry in the world is caused by people trying to make decisions before they have sufficient knowledge on which to base a decision. Rule 2. After carefully weighing all the facts, come to a decision. Rule 3. Once a decision is carefully reached, act. Get busy carrying out your decision and dismiss all anxiety about the outcome. Rule 4. When you or any of your associates are tempted to worry about a problem, write out and answer the following questions. A. What is the problem? B. What is the cause of the problem? C. What are all possible solutions? D. What is the best solution? Part 3. How to Break the Worry Habit Before It Breaks You. Chapter 6. How to Crowd Worry Out of Your Mind. I shall never forget one night when Marion J. Douglas was a student in one of my classes. I've not used his real name. He requested me for personal reasons not to reveal his identity, but here is his real story as he told it to the class. He told us how tragedy had struck at his home not once, but twice. The first time, he had lost his 5-year-old daughter, a child he adored. He and his wife thought they couldn't endure that first loss, but as he said, 10 months later, God gave us another little girl, and she died in 5 days. This double bereavement was almost too much to bear. "I couldn't take it," this father told us. "I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I couldn't rest or relax. My nerves were utterly shaken, and my confidence gone." At last he went to the doctors. One recommended sleeping pills, and another recommended a trip. He tried both, but neither remedy helped. He said, "My body felt as if it were encased in a vise, and the jaws of the vise were being drawn tighter and tighter." The tension of grief, if you've ever been paralyzed by sorrow, you know what he meant. But thank God I had one child left, a 4-year-old son. He gave me the solution to my problem. One afternoon, as I sat around feeling sorry for myself, he asked, "Daddy, will you build a boat for me?" I was in no mood to build a boat. In fact, I was in no mood to do anything. But my son is a persistent little fellow. I had to give in. Building that toy boat took about 3 hours. By the time it was finished, I realized that those 3 hours spent building that boat were the first hours of mental relaxation and peace that I had had in months. That discovery jarred me out of my lethargy and caused me to do a bit of thinking, the first real thinking I had done in months. I realized that it's difficult to worry if you're busy doing something that requires planning and thinking. In my case, building the boat had knocked worry out of the ring, so I resolved to keep busy. The following night, I went from room to room in the house, compiling a list of jobs that ought to be done. Scores of items needed to be repaired. Bookcases, stair steps, storm windows, window shades, knobs, locks, leaky faucets. Astonishing as it seems, in the course of 2 weeks, I had made a list of 242 items that needed attention. During the last 2 years, I have completed most of them. Besides, I have filled my life with stimulating activities. 2 nights per week, I attend adult education classes in New York. I have gone in for civic activities in my hometown, and I am now chairman of the school board. I attend scores of meetings. I help collect money for the Red Cross and other activities. I'm so busy now that I have no time for worry. No time for worry. That's exactly what Winston Churchill said when he was working 18 hours a day at the height of the war. When he was asked if he worried about his tremendous responsibilities, he said, "I'm too busy. I have no time for worry." Charles Kettering was in the same fix when he started out to invest in a self-starter for automobiles. Mr. Kettering was, until his retirement, vice president of General Motors, in charge of the world-famous General Motors Research Corporation. But in those days, he was so poor that he had to use the hayloft of a barn as a laboratory. To buy groceries, he had to use $1,500 that his wife had made by giving piano lessons. Later, he had to borrow $500 on his life insurance. I asked his wife if she wasn't worried at a time like that. "Yes," she replied, "I was so worried I couldn't sleep, but Mr. Kettering wasn't. He was too absorbed in his work to worry." The great scientist Pasteur spoke of the peace that is found in libraries and laboratories. Why is peace found there? Because the men in libraries and laboratories are usually too absorbed in their tasks to worry about themselves. Research men rarely have nervous breakdowns. They haven't time for such luxuries. Why does such a simple thing as keeping busy help to drive out anxiety? Because of a law, one of the most fundamental laws ever revealed by psychology. And that law is that it is utterly impossible for any human mind, no matter how brilliant, to think of more than one thing at any given time. You don't quite believe it. Very well, then, let's try an experiment. Suppose you lean back right now, close your eyes, and try at the same instant to think of the Statue of Liberty and of what you plan to do tomorrow morning. Go ahead, try it. You found out, didn't you, that you could focus on either thought in turn, but never on both simultaneously. Well, the same thing is true in the field of emotions. We cannot be pepped up and enthusiastic about doing something exciting and feel dragged down by worry at the very same time. One kind of emotion drives out the other. And it was that simple discovery that enabled Army psychiatrists to perform such miracles during the Second World War. When men came out of battle, so shaken by the experience that they were called psychoneurotic, Army doctors prescribed "keep 'em busy" as the cure. Every waking minute of these nerve-shocked men was filled with activity, usually outdoor activities such as fishing, hunting, playing ball, golf, taking pictures, making gardens, and dancing. They were given no time for brooding over their terrible experiences. Occupational therapy is the term now used by psychiatry when work is prescribed as though it were a medicine. It is not new. The old Greek physicians were advocating it 500 years before Christ was born. The Quakers were using it in Philadelphia in Ben Franklin's time. A man who visited a Quaker sanitarium in 1774 was shocked to see that the patients who were mentally ill were busy spinning flax. He thought these poor unfortunates were being exploited, until the Quakers explained that they found that their patients actually improved when they did a little work. It was soothing to the nerves. Any psychiatrist will tell you that work, keeping busy, is one of the best anesthetics ever known for sick nerves. Henry W. Longfellow found that out for himself when he lost his young wife. His wife had been melting some sealing wax at a candle one day when her clothes caught on fire. Longfellow heard her cries and tried to reach her in time, but she died from the burns. For a while, Longfellow was so tortured by the memory of that dreadful experience that he nearly went insane. But fortunately for him, his three small children needed his attention. In spite of his own grief, Longfellow undertook to be father and mother to his children. He took them for walks, told them stories, played games with them, and immortalized their companionship in his poem, The Children's Hour. He also translated Dante, and all these duties combined kept him so busy that he forgot himself entirely and regained his peace of mind. As Tennyson declared when he lost his most intimate friend, Arthur Hallam, "I must lose myself in action, lest I wither in despair." Most of us have little trouble losing ourselves in action while we have our noses to the grindstone and are doing our day's work, but the hours after work, they are the dangerous ones. Just when we're free to enjoy our own leisure and ought to be the happiest, that's when the blue devils of worry attack us. That's when we begin to wonder whether we're getting anywhere in life, whether we're in a rut, whether the boss meant anything by that remark he made today, or whether we're losing our sex appeal. When we're not busy, our minds tend to become a near vacuum. Every student of physics knows that nature abhors a vacuum. The nearest thing to a vacuum that you and I will probably ever see is inside of an incandescent electric light bulb. Break that bulb, and nature forces air in to fill the theoretical empty space. Nature also rushes in to fill the vacant mind. With what? Usually with emotions. Why? Because emotions of worry, fear, hate, jealousy, and envy are driven by primeval vigor and the dynamic energy of the jungle. Such emotions are so violent that they tend to drive out of our minds all peaceful, happy thoughts and emotions. James L. Mercell, professor of education, Teachers College, Columbia, put it very well when he said, "Worry is most apt to ride you ragged not when you're in action, but when the day's work is done. Your imagination can run riot then and bring up all sorts of ridiculous possibilities and magnify each little blunder. At such a time," he continued, "your mind is like a motor operating without its load. It races and threatens to burn out its bearings or even to tear itself to bits. The remedy for worry is to get completely occupied doing something constructive." But you don't have to be a college professor to realize this truth and put it into practice. During the Second World War, I met a housewife from Chicago who told me how she discovered for herself that the remedy for worry is to get completely occupied doing something constructive. I met this woman and her husband in the dining car while I was traveling from New York to my farm in Missouri. This couple told me that their son had joined the armed forces the day after Pearl Harbor. The woman told me that she had almost wrecked her health worrying over that only son. Where was he? Was he safe or in action? Would he be wounded or killed? When I asked her how she overcame her worry, she replied, "I got busy." She told me that at first she had dismissed her maid and tried to keep busy by doing all her housework herself, but that didn't help much. "The trouble was," she said, "that I could do my housework almost mechanically without using my mind, so I kept on worrying while making the beds and washing the dishes. I realized I needed some new kind of work that would keep me busy both mentally and physically every hour of the day. So I took a job as a saleswoman in a large department store." "That did it," she said. "I immediately found myself in a whirlwind of activity. Customers swarming around me asking for prices, sizes, colors, never a second to think of anything except my immediate duty. And when night came, I could think of nothing except getting off my aching feet. As soon as I ate dinner, I fell into bed and instantly became unconscious. I had neither the time nor the energy to worry." She discovered for herself what John Cowper Powys meant when he said, in The Art of Forgetting the Unpleasant, a certain comfortable security, a certain profound inner peace, a kind of happy numbness soothes the nerves of the human animal when absorbed in its allotted tasks. And what a blessing that it is so. Osa Johnson, one of the world's most famous women explorers, told me how she found release from worry and grief. You may have read the story of her life. It's called I Married Adventure. If any woman ever married adventure, she certainly did. Martin Johnson married her when she was 16 and lifted her feet off the sidewalks of Chanute, Kansas, and set them down on the wild jungle trails of Borneo. For a quarter of a century, this Kansas couple traveled all over the world, making motion pictures of the vanishing wildlife of Asia and Africa. Some years later, they were on a lecture tour showing their famous films. They took a plane out of Denver bound for the coast. The plane plunged into a mountain. Martin Johnson was killed instantly. The doctors said Osa would never leave her bed again. But they didn't know Osa Johnson. 3 months later, she was in a wheelchair, lecturing before large audiences. In fact, she addressed over 100 audiences that season, all from a wheelchair. When I asked her why she did it, she replied, "I did it so I would have no time for sorrow and worry." Osa Johnson had discovered the same truth that Tennyson had sung about a century earlier, "I must lose myself in action, lest I wither in despair." Admiral Byrd discovered this same truth when he lived all alone for 5 months in a shack that was literally buried in the great glacial ice cap that covers the South Pole, an ice cap that holds nature's oldest secrets, an ice cap covering an unknown continent larger than the United States and Europe combined. Admiral Byrd spent 5 months there alone. No other living creature of any kind existed within 100 miles. The cold was so intense that he could hear his breath freeze and crystallize as the wind blew it past his ears. In his book, Alone, Admiral Byrd tells all about those 5 months he spent in bewildering and soul-shattering darkness. The days were as black as the nights. He had to keep busy to preserve his sanity. "At night," he says, "before blowing out the lantern, I formed the habit of blocking out the morrow's work. It was a case of assigning myself an hour, say, to the escape tunnel, half an hour to leveling drift, an hour to straightening up the fuel drums, an hour to cutting bookshelves in the walls of the food tunnel, and 2 hours to renew a broken bridge in the man-hauling sledge. It was wonderful," he says, "to be able to dole out the time in this way. It brought me an extraordinary sense of command over myself." And he adds, "Without that, or an equivalent, the days would have been without purpose, and without purpose they would have ended, as such days always end, in disintegration." And note that last again. "Without purpose, the days would have ended, as such days always end, in disintegration." If you and I are worried, let's remember that we can use good old-fashioned work as a medicine. That was said by no less an authority than the late Dr. Richard C. Cabot, formerly professor of clinical medicine at Harvard. In his book, What Men Live By, Dr. Cabot says, "As a physician, I have had the happiness of seeing work cure many persons who have suffered from trembling palsy of the soul, which results from overmastering doubts, hesitations, vacillation, and fear. Courage given us by our work is like the self-reliance which Emerson has made forever glorious." If you and I don't keep busy, if we sit around and brood, we will hatch out a whole flock of what Charles Darwin used to call the wibber-jibbers. And the wibber-jibbers are nothing but old-fashioned gremlins that will run us hollow and